Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast and our Superintendent Series, which is brought to you by our friends over at Toro. Among the countless reasons why we go to the course, communing with Mother Nature sits near the top of most lists. And the company most trusted to responsibly maintain our golf environments, Toro, continues to lead the way. Its line of all-electric and hybrid mowers and vehicles do their jobs as well as ever. Better, actually, because their precision, power, reliability, and comfort remain the same. This new breed reduces engine exhaust emissions and noise pollution and increases efficiency and ease of maintenance. If only our golf swings were that productive and sustainable. Follow at Toro Golf on Twitter and reach out to your local Toro distributor to schedule a demo. Today I interview Jordan Kaplan, who is the head superintendent at Belvedere Golf Club, which is up in the northern part of Lower Peninsula of Michigan. That's an important distinction that I learned this week. You know, northern Michigan, I think the Upper Peninsula people consider Lower Michigan. You know, it's not northern to them. So anyways, he's up in Charlevoix, Michigan at Belvedere. It is a William Watson design. It's a semi-private golf club that offers public play tee times every day. It is a phenomenal place to play golf, and Jordan has done a wonderful job in the recent years. It was restored by Bruce Hepner in 2016, I believe, and Jordan took over last year. He had been at Philadelphia Cricket Club and came back to Michigan, where he was from originally, and he has done a wonderful job taking care of the place and getting it in some of the best shape it's ever been. So we talk about just kind of Michigan getting there and his career thus far and Belvedere. So without further ado, here is Jordan Kaplan.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg,
the dreaded fried egg
lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Yeah, but when you were in Philly, you were at the Cricket Club. When this job came up, like when you came out to interview, were you just, had you been here before? You know, what was...
Yeah, so, you know, I grew up in Michigan, so definitely coming up up north, I was familiar with Charlevoix. My wife and I actually were married in Charlevoix. There's a cool little castle. It's called Castle Farms. So, you know, I wanted to get married in a castle. My wife wanted to get married at a farm. So it worked out perfect for us.
Look at that. Castle Farms.
Yeah.
Did you Google Castle Farm?
You know, we just wanted something more of a destination, and it was a beautiful spot. So I flew into Traverse City for my interview. I knew exactly where I was going, and it you know, it felt like I was here the day before. So, you know, it definitely helped to be familiar with the place, and it beats Philadelphia. I love Philly, but it beats it by, you know, 1,000%.
Talk about quite a transition going from Philadelphia in an agronomy job in Philadelphia to Northern Michigan. What's that been like?
It's, you know, Northern Michigan's it's a great place to grow grass. You can afford a mistake or two. Philly East Coast is just ruthless. It's so hot and humid. 1,000 things can go wrong during the summer. You know, on the flip side, while the summer up here might be a little better, easier pace to manage a golf course, I'd kind of compare our winter up here to the summer there, to where in the winter here anything can go wrong, you know, under the snow or with ice. But yeah, just you know, you're not walking out the door like you were in Philadelphia, and it's 85 with 100% humidity, and the sun hasn't even come up yet.
Yeah, you like walk outside to lather, like you're sweating.
You just walk outside and it's, you know, here we go. So yeah, I love it. You know, definitely loved working in Philly, you know, despite the summers and the grind. But yeah, it's just great up here.
That had to be a big transition besides just the pace of life from Philadelphia to Northern Michigan, but like the club, like a giant club, like the Cricket Club, three courses, you know, with probably almost 1,000 members, maybe more than 1,000.
Yeah, no, you're correct in that. Yeah, the Cricket Club was just a big machine, golf, but was also fortunate enough to be at the Philadelphia campus, the St. Martin's campus, where that kind of was your country club feel, where there was the pool, there was tennis, we had grass tennis courts there, and then the 9-hole St. Martin's golf course.
Did you maintain the tennis course too?
Yeah, which is you know, that was really cool. It was something different. You know, I'm still kind of geeked out by grass tennis, and you know, there's a number of facilities in the States that, you know, I still follow. And
was there basically 100% crossover between golf and tennis maintenance, or did you do different things for tennis, or were there things that are standard practice in tennis that you could bring to golf?
I would say if you can manage turf, you could manage a grass tennis court. The only difference being some of the intricacies with the line painting, but a lot of moving parts. I mean, to mow an approach on a golf course, you just start going. You know, to mow a tennis court, you got to move tennis nets. You've got to you know, then paint the lines after. There's divider nettings between the courts. So the grass part, pretty much, if you can do it on a golf course, you can do it on a tennis court. It's just there's some additional moving parts and a, you know, additional running and twisting and traffic that surface would experience.
So in terms of difficulty of maintenance, is baseball field easiest, tennis court second, golf course third? How would you, what's the hierarchy?
I think each presents its challenges, and
we need an answer. You know, we can't have they're all tough.
Yeah, you know, the thing about a baseball field or even, you know, the little you know, not little, but it was 4 acres of manicured.
What about
grass.
Croquet?
I'd say that the difference between a golf course is you're spread out and you've got, you know, numerous different areas of the course. And on a baseball field, you could stand on home plate and see the whole thing. So, you know, I think that the vastness of the golf course is what makes it a little more challenging.
So just the sheer size of...
Yeah, yep.
I imagine tennis has got to be tough because of the running thing.
Yeah. And then, you know, so the kicker is in Philly, it's hot. These courts were predominantly POA and, you know, definitely need water. So, you know, the kicker is you on a golf course, if you needed a cut in between a group and, you know, spray down the green, you can. I mean, you could still putt on that. You can't really have a wet surface for tennis players. So, you know, another facet of that was just having a good rotation. You know, rotating the tennis players, knowing, okay, I need a water here. They'll play on this court that was watered in the morning and is dry now. So,
do you top dress a tennis court?
We didn't, you know, but, you know, certainly when we aerated, we dragged the cores around.
You aerate?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do tennis players react the same way as golfers?
You know,
the
Cricket Club, it was nice at the Cricket Club because the tennis courts were used, you know, between Memorial Day and Labor Day in the shoulder season. Everything nets was stripped off the area and it was used to actually play cricket still. So we focused our aeration in the shoulder season of tennis. But yeah, you wouldn't want to play tennis on a grass court right after it was aerated.
Were tennis players pickier about their playing surface or are golfers?
I think it's, you know, I'll put it this way. No tennis at the Belvedere Golf Course, and I'm fine with that.
I guess like tennis players can't complain about hole locations, though.
That's true. Yeah, yeah, and the net's where it is every day, so you can't complain about the net location.
So, getting to Belvedere, this place is a very historic place. There have not been many golf pros. There haven't been many superintendents. What's it like, you know, taking over for somebody that's been here for, you know, decades?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the cool part is since the club was built in 1925, I'm the fourth superintendent in its history, and my predecessor Rick Runch was here for 30 years, you know, and did numerous things from when he started to take the course to where it is now, and it's kind of like a passing of the torch, and I'm going to put my spin on it and take it the direction it needs to go for, you know, hopefully the next 25, 30 years as well. So yeah, I mean, it always helps, you know, to have new eyes on something. You know, Rick was a superintendent in a different generation than I am. So, you know, I don't know if, you know, a robotic mower or something. I'm not saying that's what we're looking into, but there's so many things that, you know, that I'm learning now and open to, that ultimately, you know, could benefit the golf course.
With anything, you look at different generations, like you look at like building architecture, which I think like mirrors golf architecture in a lot of ways. Like you see the trends of building architecture today versus, you know, what they were in the 90s, and it's like starkly different, but golf course maintenance is obviously changing a lot. And I think, you know, one of the things is less inputs, you know, eyes towards a little bit more sustainability from, you know, what we're, you know, putting into the grass, but then also, you know, a big emphasis on a playing surface rather than, you know, a visual. You mentioned how, you know, you're a different era of superintendent. Like, what are the things that you're trying to bring to Belvedere that are kind of new to the club in the last 2 years?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, you know, if, you know, wherever you are, you want to maintain the course to the membership's expectations. And, you know, it was a great golf course when I showed up on day one. You know, if you did nothing, it would be great. We're ultimately just trying to refine some details, you know, to ultimately keep it in that William Watson vision and be as close to that as we can. You know, one thing, popular terminology, fast and firm. You know, we're definitely trying to be as judicious with our watering as we can be to get some of those crazy bounces out there. You know, we host a Hickory event, the Belvedere Open, every year. We've hosted the U.S. Hickory Open in the past before I got here, but you know, the course, when they played in June, we hadn't had a lot of rain. It was so firm. It just played perfectly into what Hickory golf is all about, and getting some cool bounces. And, you know, if you're lucky, it bounced towards the cup. If you're not, it bounced the other way. So yeah, just trying to refine some details out on the course. But you know, like I said, if we didn't do anything, this is a great property. And, you know, the greens out here, green surrounds, just you know, blow people away.
Yeah, I imagine having Hickory, like a Hickory golf culture like this place has, like you're pro Marty, very into Hickory golf, like, and I think you imagine that helps, because when people come out and play Hickories and it's firm, it's such a different experience than when you play Hickories and it's soft, because the ball just doesn't, you know, react and move the way it needs to with Hickory equipment if it's soft.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's just really cool that, you know, members you know, invest the time in the, in their equipment. I mean, you might find a golf club and you don't, if it's an original club, you don't know who used it before you. You know, they definitely, you know, wear the outfits and dress the part. And it just, it fits in great for the culture here that, you know, Belvedere, play Belvedere, step back in time. What could go better than, you know, some old school hickory golf?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things about the place is like, you know, you go in like the golf house or I don't know what they call it, the pro shop, probably a pro shop.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like you go into there and it's like there's such an embrace with the history of the place. And I think obviously I played here maybe a decade and a half ago and, you know, it wasn't backed in. Obviously, they did the restoration with Bruce Hepner where they got a lot of the green surrounds back, but like you know, getting that playing surface where it is browned out, where like, you know, you look at old aerials and golf courses weren't heavily watered and everything, like matching that golf course to the feel of the golf shop and then the, you know, the old school clubhouse is such an important part of the whole experience.
Yeah. And I would also describe Marty's little pro shop as a, you know, museum of sorts. He's got,
it's unbelievable.
He's got pictures of all the great golfers who have played here, Sarazen, and, you know, could go on and on. He's always got, you know, this kind of old school jazz music playing in there. So, I mean, really, that's the experience at Belvedere. You know, forget everything else going on in the outside world. Come play golf here. Get sucked into it, and you know, realize that it's one of the few William Watson golf courses in America that really hasn't been touched. I mean, granted, the greens shrunk, but there wasn't a bulldozer brought on them or something. So the contours and stuff are all there. And, you know, everything that William Watson did with his horse teams, has survived to this day.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a neat property because obviously you have the ridge that the clubhouse sits on and, you know, some of the, you know, the road runs through it, dividing the front and the back nine for those that haven't been to Belvedere. And you've got a ridge that this road sits on, the ninth hole, the first tee, and then the 10th tee and the 18th hole sits on. That's like the prominent ridge, 17 plays on the ridge and 16 plays up to it. But then everything kind of goes off that ridge and there's a low point and they come back up. But like just how simple the golf course is with this one defined ridge, really, that everything dictates off of.
Yeah, huge, huge ridge, you know, to finish. You finish the front nine on it, you finish 18 on it, and then you're kind of winding your way through these ups and downs. You know, one of my favorite things to do in Charlevoix is just drive around on some of these country back roads.
Oh, my God.
And I just go, oh, golf course there. You could put a golf course there. And it's just, you got to wonder what, you know, what if they decided to go a mile down the road? Would it have been as good? You know, they really did a fine job selecting their spot.
So Watson lived in the winters in San Francisco, and he came here every summer.
Yeah,
right?
So he came here for, you know, 25 years after he built it, and you know, was the golf pro here. You know, so that gave him all that time too to kind of see his product and protect it from being tweaked.
I wonder how much like fine tuning he did over the years, like how many little tweaks, and he probably never like, I don't, you know, he kept decent notes, like you have some hole by hole things from him, but like, you know, I wonder, because like Ross, you always hear about Ross lived on, you know, Pinehurst on like the third hole there, right? And then he lived at Essex County, I believe, up in Boston for a period of time. And you see the holes by his house have like a little bit more pizzazz. And this is a golf course that Watson effectively lived on for summers. And the greens here are like unmistakably, like they're just unbelievable, like as potato chippy as potato chip greens get.
Yeah. You know, you got to wonder too, I mean, how willing were those guys, you know, to admit oh yeah, I did make a mistake there. I mean, they were probably pretty attached to their work, and you know, take the cricket club for example, the Tillinghast course. I believe there were some alterations by someone other than Tillinghast not too long after they did it. You know, Tilly probably wouldn't have, you know, condoned any of that. So I think you're probably right. He was probably happy with what he had, and any kind of major overhaul would have admitted, hey, you got this wrong or something.
That's the interesting thing with today. Like, an architect builds a golf course, and sometimes, like, they don't even play the golf course for years. Like, versus then, like, a lot of times an architect might work at the club or live at the club or, you know, built the golf course and was a member, you know, prominent member. Like, Stevie McDonald obviously had houses at every golf course he built. Like, you know, these, you think about how much architecture changed. Obviously, like, Ross didn't play every golf course, but like with Watson living here, like it's just such a different dynamic. Like, we don't have golf architects that necessarily build their golf courses and then just spend every summer at them.
Absolutely.
for 2 decades, yeah. 3 decades.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, a labor of love for Mr. William Watson, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing, obviously, I think, like, the one glaring thing at the golf course is the bunker style. Like, that's the one thing that is a little bit missing from, like, just pure throwback as you come out. And the bunkers were renovated in the 90s. And obviously, they probably were, like, a, you know, needed renovation of some sort, needed work. But now you have not really a intricately shaped, they're kind of a, you know, imagine if I built a bunker, it might look like that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So we have old aerials and the 1936, but then some stuff in the 50s. So even in the 50s, the bunkers, you know, mimic the, you know, what we saw in the 1936 aerial. So a Watson bunker, you know, around the 60s, definitely kind of, you know, join some bunkers together, made them a little rounder. I think a lot of that goes into play too with, hey, those were easy to maintain.
Well, this is the whole architecture thing too, is like that just became like, you look at building architecture, like subdivisions came in vogue in the 50s and 60s and like the cookie cutter, like, you know,
right,
same,
right.
Like,
so that's
copy paste culture, kind
perfectly of how I would describe the bunkers now. You know, kind of a cookie cutter look to it. You know, that's what happened to every golf course in the
'60s.
Hey, let's put some trees there, and you know, let's. So I think it was at the time it was done, it was, you know, trendy and what other courses were doing. You know, you come 40 years later, and you're right. You step back in time. And that's the element that's missing. Kind of a cool side note, Bruce Hepner was out this summer and we're doing a little short game area off to the side in an old turf nursery, and he was, you know, definitely experimenting with the Watson style. So you know, that would be the first step. Let's kind of figure out what the Watson style is. It's safe to say Watson had some different bunker styles depending on where he was working. One kind of comparison that I like a lot, a year before 1924, Orinda Golf Club in California, you know, they did some restoration work there, and I think it's safe to say that Watson's style here was heavily influenced by the California work and folks he was hanging out with out there.
And that look would fit so well into this landscape too, because it's got, you know, it would sit really nicely into the hills, and it would give that kind of artistic flair that would match the flair of the greens.
Absolutely. And you know, so we you know, we know what needs to be done. You know, obviously there's a lot of stuff that goes into a bunker restoration. Yeah,
there's money.
There's a lot of things with sand and bunker liners. We won't get into that, but I think one of the other things we when we were driving around the golf course is, you know, some of the bunkers are just overbearing in the landscape. You know, so there's definitely something to be gained from a stylistic changes. Certainly the playability and drainage would improve in the bunkers. And yeah, I mean, if one of the best in the game, Bruce Hoepner, you know, could get his mini X bucket on some of that stuff, it'd be amazing. But, you know, one step at a time. You know, we also don't want to get ahead of ourselves, because like we did say, I mean, regardless of bunkers or this or that, you know, it's all about the greens out here, you know, so we'll keep on it. We'll be getting there.
I think that's a cool way to do it too, is like you get the short game area. It gives like members a chance to see, you know, like I think it's really hard for a lot of times people to envision what something might look like unless somebody does like a very intricate Photoshop rendering.
Right.
But like, you know, for somebody to be able to go out, play in it, and like hit shots out of it and also look at it, it just does wonders for the, you know, them being able to say, oh, we're going to do bunkers like this out on the golf course.
Right. And I truly believe, you know, shapers like Bruce and others, while they can put something on a plan, I think they do their best work when they just roll up to the bunker and I don't want to describe it as winging it. They certainly know what they're doing, but you know, let the juices flow out in the field. And it'd be really hard to kind of, unless you're an excellent artist, to draw what that bunker looks like. So I think we're on the right track. I mean, we're going to have a bunker that you can get your feet in and play around in. We'll try some different bunker sands and, you know, go from there. But yeah, it was just really cool to watch him go. He dug the bunkers out and then he shaped a couple of green pads, and he actually said, I've never built a green with a mini excavator before. This is kind of cool. I'm not saying he would switch to just doing it that way in the future, but yeah, he was definitely kind of in the zone and making it happen.
One of my favorite things was you're very, like, I'm a big self-deprecator of myself, and I love that we pulled up to the your new chipping green. He said, this I built this bunker, it's terrible.
Yeah, I mean, just being honest, but you know, the difference between, you know, the professionals and myself is, yeah, they don't make mistakes. You know,
you have a staff of 10 or so people. Like, there's definitely a balance of like, what can we do in-house versus make sense to outsource?
Right. Yeah, I mean, tree work, for example, you know, we do a lot of that in-house, you know, but we know too when to wave the white flag and, hey, this is a little crazy, let's bring in the professionals.
How big is the tree?
It's not necessarily the size. It's kind of like what's going on up top. What's, you know, where it's leaning. You know, I'm scared to death of willow trees. That's got to be done by a professional from the top down. Yeah.
So that's when there's more going on up top, that's when you have to start up top. You can't just cut it at the base.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. So, yeah, it's awesome to be able to do things yourself out here and be self-sufficient. You know, you got to know when to call them in. You know, at the cricket club, we laid like a mile of brick paths, walk paths around the club, and we did it all ourselves in house. You know, the savings on that, to have a contractor do it. I think
everybody can relate to that. That's ever done like a house project.
And they turned out, you know, they turned out great.
Now for a quick word from our sponsor, Toro. For more than a century, with cutting-edge turf equipment and irrigation solutions, Toro has had your front nine covered and your back nine too. In fact, Toro's always had your back, period. Toro is as committed to your long-term success as tour pros are committed to their shot. That's down to top-notch customer support from Toro and its local dedicated distributors, both of whom are passionate about delivering turf equipment and irrigation solutions that solve real-world problems. Follow at Toro Golf on Twitter and reach out to your local Toro distributor today. Now back to Jordan Kaplan. Talking about winter, is everybody talks about winter being awful here from just a living standpoint. I kind of disagree. I think there's stuff to do. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, 100%. You know, skiing, snowboarding, there's a cool little just slope in town with tow ropes for kids to use. The Boyne Resorts, which aren't too far away. I mean, that's probably classified as the best skiing up in, you know, this part of the Midwest.
Which is like below average to me, you know, before any ski snobs.
So it's what you make of it. You know, I guess my biggest thing is it can snow as much as it wants up here. Snow living in, you know, in an inner city like Chicago or Philadelphia is just miserable. So
just after like 2 days, it turns to brown ice.
Yeah. So I'll take the snow as long as you're in the right setting and you have some good outlets to, you know, enjoy it.
What are you doing in the winter? Like, what's that look like? You said that's when you have to be really careful with ice and such and damage on the greens. How do you monitor that? Like, what's a recipe for something that you really need to be worried about?
Yeah, I mean, the best is you know, when you just have kind of a light fluffy snow on there, even if it's a foot deep. You know, that snow's got, you know, pore spaces in it and all good. The nightmare scenario is if you get a meltdown and then you get an ice layer that forms. You don't want your grass to be
Essentially creates like a impermeable surface that the grass can't breathe, right?
Yep. The snow itself is nice, you know, protection from wind and everything else. In fact, you know, this spring our snow melted pretty early and it got pretty hot and you know, for that time of year and windy and things were drying out before the irrigation system was turned on. So, you know, to have had that snow cover for an extra 2 weeks would actually been, you know, favorable to just protect the grass. So yeah, I do a lot of you know, I'll walk around, I'll get some snowshoes on and walk around the course, just kind of check on things. I know,
how much harder is it to walk with snowshoes?
It's I think it beats going in.
Is it like 1.5 times walking, or, you know, like?
I think if anything, it's a good workout. It beats, you know, sinking down a foot into the snow.
Well, obviously it's better. You know, they exist for a reason. But like, you know, are we talking like, what's the strain level versus walking on just grass? Like,
you feel the burn. Yeah.
You feel the burn?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you might be in better shape in the winter than.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, you almost need to get yourself in pre-winter shape for that.
You gotta start walking snowshoes on the grass.
Yeah, now if I wanted to get fancy, maybe someday I'll buy myself a snowmobile and drive that around. But I also wouldn't want anybody driving by to see me on that, because, you know, they might think, oh, it's the new snowmobile park at the Belvedere. So
and then you wouldn't get all the exercise.
Right.
So with the you know, with the, I wonder if global warming, obviously, like, everywhere is getting hotter. So, like, do you think, like, that early spring might become more and more of a thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Have you talked to Rick at all about, like, how it changed over his career?
I think the bottom line is, living on Lake Michigan is you never know what you're going to get with, with the amount of snowfall. It's, for me, it's just really hard to keep track of what is normal now, you know, even in Philly, to say, hey, this is the hottest year ever, and you're like, well, last year was pretty hot, or so it's tough. The big issue around here is when the lake levels start to rise, and you know, there's a lot of beautiful homes on Lake Charlevoix and Lake Michigan, and maybe not quite equipped to handle a, you know, rise in water level. You know, so the lakes up here, changes in water level, I think that all plays hand to hand in the climate that we experience here in Michigan.
Mm-hmm. In the winter, I always think snow on a golf course like kind of accentuates sometimes contour, like, and then obviously the trees don't have any leaves. Are there things that you've noticed in the winter, like any examples of stuff that you've noticed on the golf course in the winter that you wouldn't have seen if you weren't walking around? And
yeah, I mean, I love looking at that, you know, snow cover. The other really nice way to see contours on the golf course, it's hard to video, but if you drive around the course at night with your lights on, you see the funkiest stuff going on that you would never see in daylight. So with the snow, you can also kind of, okay, so there's a big snowbank over here. That means that area of the golf course gets windswept. Mm-hmm. You know, hey, that's why that area dries out, because of the wind in the summertime. So there are a number of things, you know, that you can gather. You know, snow melted here first in the valley.
That means it gets probably a lot of sun, right?
Right, right. And you know, the when you're coming out of snow melt, I mean, I'd still consider that winter time. That winter sun is just as important to the grass as, you know, sunlight would be during the growing season. You know, so even though a tree might not have its leaves on it, it very well could be, you know, hindering some of that winter sunshine that, you know, ultimately you need to get the place green and growing again come the season. We had I've been a little spoiled. I mean, we've had two pretty good starts of the season in my 2 years here. That I will take.
What you took over for longtime superintendent, retained the staff. Like, was there, you know, what were the things that, you know, obviously you wanted to impart your practices, but you have a staff that's been used to, you know, doing things one way. How was the process of kind of working and things that you wanted to do? I imagine you can't just be a heavy-handed approach. Like,
yeah, I mean, I have to commend them, because I mean, it probably was a little scary. Hey, I've worked here for Rick for X number of years, a new guy coming in. I mean, and in some situations that probably is what happens. New guy comes in and just cleans house. They were all very you know, willing and helpful in my transition. And I think they're kind of seeing the method to the madness. You know, if they're noticing the course is looking good and they're getting some high fives when they're out there, you know, I think we're on the right track, and they're all great guys, and they, you know, come to work and give it all they got, and they all care about this place too. So that's been, you know, one of the blessings to have had the staff that Rick had in place and just make some tweaks to, you know, take it the next level direction that we want to go in.
You know, obviously Philly people versus upper Midwest people, it was, you know, coming back, leaving and coming back, you know, what are the differences in just working with people in the Midwest? I don't want to get you in trouble with anybody in Philadelphia. I think all Philadelphians are pretty aware of their, you know, of their personas. Is it, you know, managing people in the two different places, is it distinctly different?
Yeah, I mean, as far as, you know, working side by side, hardworking folks who work on the golf course, I mean, yeah, that's the same, you know.
And then membership too, it's got to be a little bit different.
I think I just feel like people are a little more relaxed up here. You just come and you throw it all away.
It's a vacation club too versus an everyday club.
True. So I think there's just a little more. You know, it's a little more chill up here. It fits my personality well. you know, I'm a little more laid back in some regards too. So it's just a good lifestyle up here. You know, you know why our members choose to spend their summers up in Charlevoix.
You know, obviously Belvedere is a well-known vacation club, right? Because, and it's well-known because it's public. But then there's all these other ones up here that are just like, kind of like these little places that have some neat stuff going on. And what's the dynamic with like the superintendents up here? Does everybody kind of, do you guys get together every once in a while, or how's that work? Cause you're all at these little lake town clubs.
Yeah. So, so one thing about, so Belvedere, I think this is a misconception, but, Belvedere is a private golf club. Yes. that allows, you know, outside play. I think the term semi-private's kind of weird. But as far as the area, there's so many great golf courses. There's the golf course, Superintendent Association of Michigan is top notch. It's all under one umbrella. So everybody in the state gets together, and, in particular, the superintendents up north, who I've met and interacted with, were just, you know, super welcoming. I was obviously an outsider, but, you know, welcomed me with open arms. And gosh, there's some talented superintendents up here who would be successful at, you know, in any region of the country. So yeah, it's a great, great state to be a superintendent in. It's a great state for golf courses.
I feel like Central Michigan superintendents and Southeast probably, you know, have just, you know, some angst about you guys and your growing conditions.
Yeah. Gosh,
they like to poke fun or something.
I've talked to, you know, this year in particular, I've talked to some folks in the Detroit area, and they've had a lot of rain. So I feel for them, for sure. But, yeah, it's a good community. You know, obviously up north, we're a little farther away from everybody else. So maybe we are a little tighter, of a group. But you know, you can't, talk about a golf trip. You know, if you wanted to spend some time in Northern Michigan, you couldn't go wrong. I mean, I would hit up Arcadia Bluffs, you know, spend some time at Forest Dunes, you know, certainly stop by and see us at Belvedere. But, you know, if you also just get off the beaten path, I mean, you're bound to discover kind of a sleeper.
That's the thing. There's so many courses up here. Just stop. I mean, like, this is why I find myself. I just get off the road and go look. Even if you just go pull into the parking lot and get out and walk a couple hundred yards, you probably see something cool. Because like you said about driving around, like the land's just so good that like it's almost hard to build bad golf when you have the land. And it, I mean, the playing, the sandy soil up here is also, this is sand, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's the thing. I always look at the side of the road when I'm driving down the road to see if it's like sand or not. And it's like, everything up here is sand. It's the amazing thing about the whole place. It's just like all the little lakes, all the sand bottom lakes, like all the, you know, it's just such an amazing place.
It's right up there with any other, you know, popular golf destination trip. Now granted, you can't do it in the winter, so yeah, go to Pinehurst then. But yeah, it's awesome. You know, our course is there are some sandy spots. You know, some of it was cut through a old cedar swamp, so that's a little more of a, you know, mucky kind of soil, but it's not a heavy clay soil. So yeah, I mean, you could have a golf course every square mile up here, you know.
What you did a little bit of a green expansion on the back of 8. How'd you go about that? Like, what process did you do to expand the green in the back there?
Yeah, so there was a maple tree that grew behind 8. You know, through some old pictures, I mean, you know, maybe it was considered the iconic tree, but in reality, that tree wasn't there when William Watson built that green. He built that green to kind of be a, you know, infinity green that sits up on the horizon.
It's right up on that prominent ridge we talked about early in the podcast.
So once we removed the tree, we basically just took the old approach and started mowing it lower. And we've got some, you know, top dressing to catch it up on. And
so you mowed it, like scalped it effectively.
Yep, pretty much scalped it, but it wasn't too dramatic.
And then what do you do? Then you
we'll definitely, you know, include it in our greens aeration, top dressing, get some seed in there. I mean, another thing is anytime there's a void, just put a plug in it, you know. Mm-hmm. So we're getting it to where it will be, you know, look uniform with the rest of the green. It will obviously grow better because it doesn't have the canopy of the tree above it. And there's some pinnable spots back there that we'll be excited to use. You know, we 2025 will be our 100th year anniversary, and we'll be hosting the Michigan Amateur again.
This course was the every year host for a long time.
This course, yeah, it was known as the home of the Michigan Amateur. I think 40 times, it'll be 40, 41 and 25. We wanted to do it then to coincide with our anniversary.
So you're just gearing up for that.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's coming up, and, you know, to see kind of what we've accomplished in just a short amount of time, we're going to be looking awesome for that. And, you know, can't wait. It's not the longest course that, you know, those guys probably play, but again, I think the greens will keep them honest. If it's windy, you know, good luck, guys. And,
Having played a few state amps, like, I would hate to have to play the 16th hole in a very high pressure situation.
Oh my gosh,
hitting
yeah.
a wedge into that green.
Yep.
It's just terrifying.
It could make or break you.
Yeah. And if you bail, it's just the ultimate delayed penalty, depending on where the pin is. Like, you might be laying up to just hope to get out of with five from just off the green. Like,
yeah.
It is.
Well, the good news is, I will, gladly let the Golf Association of Michigan select the pin locations for events like that. Although I will say you would be qualified yourself to do that as well when you were out changing cups with me this morning.
No. That's well, I think that's like the most fun thing to do is set pins. I love you that's
have,
like why
you have all that power in your hand every morning. You know,
I think
it's
part
a rush.
Of the reason we have all of our events is just so I get to set up a golf course. I think that's like one of the most fun things to do. Is and I always wish like in I don't know you know I don't know any membership or any course that's ready for this, but I always want to have back tees in front of middle tees, maybe front tee behind a middle tee, and, you know, change it up, have people play different places. I think for like a your back tee moving 16 up to 270 would create a very interesting decision for long hitters. Like, what do I do? I don't necessarily want to miss this 20 yards left of that green. And that's what brings into play when you move it up to where you could drive the hole.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I know you've made this point before, but you know, switch it up. Don't play the same golf course every day. One thing, my daughters are 5 and 3. My 5-year-old just got her first set of golf clubs, but as she gets better, I mean, in my mind, I'm just going to play the forward tees that she plays with, you know, with hickory clubs or something. You could, take the driver out of your bag, or
well, that's like if you're a good player, one of the best activities.
Well,
you
I'm not
could,
saying I'm
know,
a good player, but.
I know, but like any player, this is one of the best activities you can do. Like if you're trying to break 80, if you're trying to break 90, go play the forward tees, and you like probably will get to feel the pressure of like, and it's the same thing for like a good player who's trying to shoot more and more under par. Is like the best thing you can do is put yourself into a position where you get under par quickly and have to keep going because you're playing, just play the up tees, play the forward tees, and just try and shoot as low as you can.
Yeah.
Or if you're trying to break 90, you're struggling to get over the threshold of breaking 90 or 80, go play like way up and get yourself into the feeling
Oh,
I'm going to break. Like your expectation changes, and that's a good thing.
To me, it's still golf.
Yeah.
You know, it's all golf.
It's fun. How have you gone about getting your daughter into the game? Has she been really interested? Because that's what you do. Like I'm at, I have a 1-year-old, and this is something I'm very interested in now is how people get their.
Yeah, I don't want to be, you know, pushy on them, but you know, she sees that it's something dad does, or you know, dad's got it on TV. I think for her, I hope she loves the sport, but if we spend time on the golf course, it'll be more about, you know, us spending time together. But yeah, I'm excited. You know, we started with the plastic clubs, hit those in the backyard, and she just got her own little bag with the four clubs in it, and she'll just walk around the backyard with it on. I mean, I think she loves it. She asked me to get my golf bag the other day and walk with her, and no, I don't. I just need this 60-degree wedge. I don't need to carry my whole bag, but
just walking around the backyard.
It might be about all the accessories for her, you know.
I think that's the hands off approach is probably the best way.
Yeah. Yep.
I'm excited. We have this one hickory club. A friend of mine got like a birth gift with her name on it.
Oh, that's great.
And she just sits and hammers it under the ground. Like, I don't know what to do with the club. Like, should I hang it up somewhere? But I just give it to her. And
she'll
she just...
if she knows golf is something that you do, she'll do it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Just to humor me.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Well, what's in the plans for this fall and in the winter here? What are your big projects?
Yeah, we're just gonna we've got to wrap up our little short game project.
You gotta get seed down soon, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah.
This is like peak growing time.
Yeah,
right?
we're in it. So for sure, you know, definitely want to see some green before winter out there. And then just you know, there'll be a gradual drop off of, you know, membership leaving and things slowing down on the golf course. Marty holds a fun he calls it the Blitz tournament at the end of the year, and it's crazy cups and everything. So that's kind of the last hurrah in October, and then you know, we'll have the place to ourselves a little bit, get some things done, you know, before the winter, and see where it takes us. I'm looking forward to you know, just a little bit of peace and quiet on the golf course. It's been busy this year. I love seeing golfers enjoy the place, but you know, sometimes I love being out there by myself in the winter too. So yeah.
Peace and quiet, and I assume you're a Lions football fan.
No.
that's good for you.
I'm not doing that. No, thanks. I decided that I grew up in Michigan. I moved around a lot, so I never truly had a professional team. But I decided when I left Philly, lived there for 7 years, that I would stay allegiant to
the Eagles,
to the Philly teams. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Transplant Philly sports.
Yeah, well,
fan.
I've got too many hats and shirts to go the other way.
Man, I didn't see that coming. You know, Midwesterner turned into a Philly sports fan is quite the heel turn.
Who would have thought? Yeah.
All right, Jordan, thank you for coming on. I'm excited to see, you know, the next dozens of years that you're here and where Belvedere goes.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's episode was edited by Meg Atkins. As a reminder, we have some great stuff in the Pro Shop. One of my favorites with fall approaching is our hoodie. We get lots of comments about this hoodie. I would size up if you're in between sizes. If you're kind of medium large, go large. They run a little small, but a lot of people say this is like the softest hoodie they own. This is the most comfortable hoodie they own. I agree. I love our hoodies. So I would check that out. It's got the cool alternate logo with the green. And that's available in the Fried Egg Pro Shop. Go to thefriedegg.com in the top right corner. You can see the Pro Shop link, and you can find it there. It's affordable, and it's a great hoodie. Thanks, and look for another episode later this week about Solheim Cup and really team picking strategy. Garrett's going to doing a podcast with Joe LaMagna, a great golf analytics follow, about team strategy and just pairing strategy. Really cool stuff. So look for that later this week, and thanks for listening again.